you're gonna have a fucking titanium tip 223 round pointed at your face. I don't think you want that. Blow me away! I don't fucking care!
I'm Yardley.
And I'm Zibby. And we're fascinated by true crime.
So we invited our friends, Detectives Dan and Dave,
to sit down with us and share their most interesting cases.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Dave.
We're identical twins,
and we're detectives in small-town USA.
Dave investigates sex crimes and child abuse.
Dan investigates violent crimes. And together, we've worked on hundreds of cases, including assaults, robberies, murders, burglaries, sex abuse, and child abuse.
Names, locations, and certain details of these cases have been altered to protect the privacy of the victims and their families.
Today on Small Town Dicks, we have
Detective Don, negotiator.
Detective George, I was on duty as a detective, but was called to the scene as a SWAT team member.
Sergeant David, I originally won the scene as the patrol sergeant, and that dovetailed into being the SWAT team sergeant. This was kind of an interesting day for me because I had just been promoted to sergeant. It was my second day on patrol as a patrol sergeant, and I hadn't been in patrol for a long time because I'd been in detectives for so long. We got a call to a residential area. Originally, it was from a medical facility in which Raymond had been calling there. He was a patient, and he was wanting pain meds. And he was a frequent flyer with them trying to get meds, and they were not going to give him any more meds. And they'd been telling him that, and he got really frustrated about that. The people at the medical clinic knew his wife, Wendy. And so at some point during these calls, they call Wendy to see if she knows what he's doing or if she's around or anything like that. And they're able to get a hold of her, and she's at work. And so they have her go home to check on Raymond. And they don't call the police. And in between the time Wendy is going to check on Raymond, Raymond calls back the medical office and starts threatening them. Says he's going to come shoot the office up if they don't give him meds. He's addicted to pain meds and he wants them, and he better get them now or he's going to come and shoot the office up. They don't really call the police at that time, but they let Wendy go over to the house to check on him. Wendy
really?
Goes to the house, yes.
Like, why wouldn't they? They didn't take him seriously, clearly.
I don't think they took him seriously, and it, quite frankly, it's ignorance. I mean, they should have called her and maybe she told him, you know, he gets like this, I'll go take care of him. And maybe they believed her. I don't know. But she goes over there at some point, and they start thinking, wow, maybe should have called the police or something. I wonder if Wendy's all right. So they start calling Wendy back. And Wendy doesn't answer her phone. They then call the police and tell us that Raymond just called us. He's been threatening to come and shoot the place up. We don't get him pain meds. We call his wife. She's gone over there. Now we can't get over her. So now we're thinking, you know, something bad may have happened. In the interim, we get Wendy's cell phone number to the dispatchers. And I went out there along with two other patrol officers to the residence. While we were on the way out there, dispatch was able to get a hold of Wendy, and she said, yes, he's in there. He's in a bad way. I took the dogs and I left. I'm down at a different place. I'm at a park with the dogs. She also tells us that he has a gun out in the house at some point, and he's just acting weird, and he's done this before. So when we got to the scene, I got an officer with me, and we're across the street looking at the front door, and I have another officer in the back of the place, and we really don't have a crime at this point. He hasn't, other than maybe menacing for calling and making the threat at the medical people. But I decide instead of knocking on the door, I'm going to call inside the house to see if I can talk to him about it.
Because you do know he has a gun.
Yeah, he's reported he has a gun. And, you know, honestly, we assume everyone's got a gun in the house in our town for some reason. A lot of them do. But I end up calling his cell phone and getting him on the line. And the conversation, unbeknownst to me, it was recorded by him. And he when this all pans out, but during this conversation, I start asking him, and he is instantly agitated that the police are out there. I think his quote is something like, when I identify myself as who I am, his response is, oh, fuck. And then it goes downhill from there. And I have a conversation with him that is really not that long, and after which he terminates the conversation and has made several threats to kill any officer he sees, and he's not coming out, and all of this stuff.
He says that on the phone. So
yes.
What did you say when you identified yourself as
Yeah, and I talked to him for not a really long period of time, and like I said, this is recorded and you will hear it, but it's I actually trying to get him to calm down, trying to get him to think rationally and trying to get him to come out. And at one point I thought I had him. There was I basically told him at one point that I would take him to the ambulance. We weren't going to take him into custody. We'd walk the ambulance and we'd start getting him some help. If he's suicidal, we'd get that kind of help. If he needs meds or whatever it is, it was just try to get him to come out. But he didn't like police. He talks about his dislike for police. And I realized at that point that this is going to be probably a SWAT call up. So I had dispatch activate the SWAT team. And again, we start arriving piecemeal. Had officers getting in position. I also had other negotiators come and try to keep contacting him to keep this conversation going. They had limited success with that and came to the same conclusion I did, I believe, that this was not going to end good. And he had made statements to me that he was basically done. And
done with what?
I assumed his life. And he would not rashly talked about anything I wanted him to do. It was all about what he was going to do if we did X, Y, and Z. And it was threats to shoot the first officer he saw. If I could stand to have the blood of my officers on my hands, then I would have them come in the house, all those kind of things. And then he told me what he was armed with. He told me he was armed with an AR-15 assault rifle with titanium tip bullets, shotgun slugs, and handguns, and all of that.
So, and you take all that at face value, I presume.
I believe everything he's saying. I mean, and that's why I'm contacting the SWAT team to get him in position. And we get in a position to contain him in the house the best we can while this negotiations is going on all the time. Everyone was in position. At some point, he bursts out of the house. The negotiations had failed. We'd actually even tried to get his wife to maybe talk to him, but she wasn't able to do that. She was actually on scene when he burst out of the house. He was told by me not to come out of the house with weapons. If he came out, he just came out with his hands up. And I think looking back at this in hindsight, I think that what my conversation with him is about not coming out of the house led to his ultimate decision what to do. It's my opinion he didn't have the guts to shoot himself, but he wanted to die that day.
All the way through bursting out of the house, he has recorded.
Yes,
and his end of
things. Yeah, he's wandering around the house throughout the day, talking to himself, playing music, and then near the end of all this, you know, we didn't know this time, but he talks himself into coming out and taking care of business
with a gun in each hand.
Yes.
Oh wow!
Should we listen to that tape?
Sergeant, I have no problem with the police. I do have a problem with the police trying to take me away. I've had shotguns put in my face and pull the trigger. The only thing the cops didn't mind is I didn't really give a shit about dying. You are not taking me. I want to inform you of something, Sergeant. Right here. It's in recording. It's going to the newspaper after I'm dead. Do you understand? Hey, listen to me. I have got titanium tipped 223 armor piercing rounds that go straight through both sides of your flak jacket. That's the first thing that's coming at you. Second is pumpkin balls. And if you want to stand up to a pumpkin ball with a flak jacket, that's your business, buddy. But I don't think you're gonna recover.
Holy shit.
Yeah. What's a pumpkin ball? He says you want to be full of pumpkin balls?
It's a shotgun slug.
And that's a common slang for a shotgun slug?
It's an old term. They used to call them that. But it's, you know, I've always heard them as slugs, but I've seen old-time stuff where they call them pumpkin balls. They're just big, round, lead balls that I think they're 60 caliber or something like that.
Seems big.
Yeah.
Originally, you showed up as patrol sergeant, and then you realize as the situation starts to devolve that you have to call in the SWAT team.
Yes. And the idea from the SWAT team angle, we cannot let someone who's armed come out and wander the streets, obviously. This house is literally right across the street from high school. And again, we had the neighborhood completely cordoned off, and it was during the daytime.
Once you realize you're being recorded, does that impact the way you proceed on your end?
Yeah, does it change the way you engage with the suspect?
We still have to do our job. I mean, it goes back to being handcuff him, secure the house, make sure there's nobody else in there. One of the difficult things we do when we go out there is you get the SWAT team out there based on his threats, but you have to assess whether you have a reason to arrest him at this point. You know, if you want to get drunk up in your house and yell and scream and do whatever, you know, have you committed a crime? Certainly you're a danger to the neighborhood. During the subsequent investigation and talking to his wife, we found out that when she went over there, after the doctor's office had called her, she found him in the upstairs bedroom, and he had a pistol out. And she told me later that he had done this before, and she had just been sick of it, you know, and she was kind of perturbed with the whole acting up, and she didn't really take him that serious. But in this occasion, he had shot two rounds into the ceiling while she was sitting there. That's when she said, "I just took the dogs and left." And it's my opinion, I think anyone with any experience would say she's lucky she's not the victim of a homicide-suicide, because he was clearly off his rocker that day.
And he was addicted to prescription drugs. Were there also illicit drugs involved in his?
We found no illegal drugs. He complained about some back surgeries gone wrong, and he got hooked on opiates and needed them.
Was he high when this whole thing went down?
No, he was out of pain medication.
He's withdrawing.
He was withdrawing, and he was in a bad way.
Was Wendy, his wife, present on the sidelines with the dogs when he actually ended up bursting out of the house?
She was probably within distance of hearing the gunshots, yes.
Did you have the ability to see the front door where he came out?
I did, but I was back behind the arrest team.
So, Detective Don, you took over negotiations with Raymond after Sergeant David transitioned into SWAT commander mode.
How did that go?
You know, when I talked to him on the phone, I responded out there with another negotiator, and we were parked like, I don't know, a block and a half down the street from his house, so we could see the perimeter. And we initially made contact with him on the phone, and it was hard to hear him because there was this rock music, I mean, blaring, I mean, full tilt on the speakers. And I think we convinced him to turn the music down a couple times because we couldn't even hear his responses. And that may have been why the music was down and then back up. But we were never able, the other negotiator between us, we have, you know, decades of experience, and neither one of us could connect with him. He was, and we talked about it at the time, he was truly batshit crazy that day. I have no doubt about it. He wasn't faking for some other reason. He wasn't vindictive, you know, upset about his wife or none of the normal things you find with people like that. He was truly out of his mind.
And I remember telling Detective Don when they showed up to take over the negotiations while I was setting the SWAT in up, I told him, "This is going to end badly." And he came to the same conclusion instantly, I think.
Because
I
could tell he was just so delusional.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, let the professional check this out. I'm the negotiator.
Oh, snap.
You know, I know what you're saying. But anyway, within seconds of talking to him, this guy's really, really fucked up.
So you're both on the tape recorded version of his?
No, well, there's two versions. There's the real long length one. Is a lot of music, you know, a lot of him wandering around in there. And I don't think any of the phone calls that you guys had with him are on it. Just the original call, and he either turned the tape recorder off or did something. I don't really know what he was doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, you get one of those things, you just vibe from this guy that, you know, he's done too. He's not, this isn't going to end good.
You know, to talk about his history, He was gainfully employed most of his life. He didn't have an adult criminal record per se. He said that day that he had had some horrible experiences with the police as a juvenile, but I'm not so sure that those weren't just created recently by his madness or whatever. But, you know, in my career, I dealt with a lot of people that try to act crazy and some people that are sort of crazy. And then I've dealt with a few that are really crazy. And that day, that particular time, I really got the feel from him that he was totally out of his mind crazy.
In a situation where it's really easy to very quickly identify that he's delusional and batshit, as you say, is that somewhat of a comfort? Does it sort of embolden you to go, oh, I'm less concerned about what he's capable of, or is it the polar opposite?
Personally, for me, it's an easy one because it's going to end badly like this. We're not going to go in looking for him probably ever. If we do, we're going to gas the house so bad that he's not going to be able to breathe. But the idea in something like this is the only thing that's kind of a – it's going to be a long one probably. We're going to try to wear him out until he just finally gets tired of talking to us and tired of threatening, or either he kills himself or he comes out and confronts us or he just gives up. And those things can last a long time.
And, you know, that was my perception talking to him, was this going to last a long time because he is at such a heightened state. It's going to take hours to talk him down, to slow him down, to get control of this. And, of course, as soon as you make that assumption, boom, he's out the door with a gun, you know, threatening our officers. So you never know. And the crazy factor is so unpredictable. I mean, this could happen 100 times everywhere else, and the guy walks out, gives up. No one predicted what he would do, but you could tell that he wasn't right. I mean, he was affected, at least at that time, with some kind of psychosis or problem, probably because of the drug withdrawals.
Sergeant David, you were talking to him initially, and then you handed off to Detective Don. If he's already not a fan of police, what is that intro? Are you sort of doing bad cop, good cop? Like, and now you're like, I know Sergeant David doesn't really get you, but I'll get you. So, I mean, what is the strategy there?
You use every little trick in the book. And if he didn't like Sergeant Dave, maybe he'll like Detective Don or Detective Jeff, who was also part of this negotiation. But nothing, I mean, this guy, he just had no sense of reality. There was no even, oh, at least he paused for a second to listen to what I had to say. There was just really none of that.
The only time he ever paused was when I was talking to him, is when I started, and you cannot hear me on the deal, but I tell him about, I sympathize with him about his back problems because I've had back surgeries myself, and that I could get him, I would walk him to the ambulance, and he slowed down for just a minute. And then when he decided he wasn't going to do that, he was right back to, he just didn't believe me. He said, no, you're tricking me. And he tells me something, you're not going to put me into suspension is what I think of what he calls it. And
like for some sort of back thing? Suspension,
no, I think he meant the nut house because he was suicidal and he didn't want to, that was beneath him, I think. I thought he was going to bite on that. And I'd have walked him straight to the ambulance if he came out with no guns.
I like your instincts, Yardley, that you were thinking about, like, what you would say, like, you know what? Yeah, cops, meh, but I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
Right?
But we're thinking in Hollywood terms. Like, I'm pretty sure we've seen a scene like that somewhere.
Sure, I'm sure we have.
Well, and in the conversation, I tell him, you know, not all cops are the same, then you'll hear his response to that.
Let's listen to it.
I think we should listen to it and then have a little chat about it afterward.
Am I doing? No, I'm sitting in the shoot. Anybody that's going to take away my freedom right now. I am in horrible fucking pain. I had a back surgery where the guy fucked up. He fucked up. I've been on some pretty strong drugs since then. My fucking doctor refuses to acknowledge what's on every website about these drugs, that they built up tolerance. I have been adjusted one time. I'm no good for this drug anymore. And I am coming apart at the seams. I don't want to live anymore. You're going to get a fucking recording on a mini disc, or my wife is, and she can forward half of it to the newspaper. The other half will be hers. You will not be a factor in this unless you come in the door and threaten my dogs. You
their
threaten
dog
my dogs,
there.
And I'm going to fucking terminate
life.
The first officer who does it. Your flak jackets. You make a short tweet. I'm not going into suspension. I've had you guys fucking point when I was 13 years old, point fucking shotguns at me for entertainment. What? What? None of your business. Yeah, a long time ago. Cops don't change. They only get worse. Yeah. Fuck you. Fuck you in your ass, buddy. You're gonna have a fucking... You're gonna have a fucking titanium tip 223 round pointed at your face. I don't think you want that. Pull me away! I don't fucking care! I don't care! Don't you understand it, buddy? I've heard for 3 days. Fuck! God damn it! That would be a pleasure! Yeah, well, good. Why don't you just put one on me and then say goodbye to a few of your own?
At some point, you hear him loading and charging weapons. Yeah, that. When he gets to the song, "Whatever Gets You Through the Night," you can hear him start loading magazines into weapons and charging them, and then you'll hear what he does after that.
I'm going outside now.
It's not. He's not there yet. But.
Is on PD. They love to shoot first. They love to shoot first.
He's like working himself up.
It's really crazy to hear this, knowing these are the last few seconds of his life.
Here he comes, getting the weapons ready. He turned the music off. Charging weapons in.
There was such a striking desperation in his voice that, yes, felt almost too over the top in a sense. But as you say, I mean, he was out of his gourd. But the music, some part of me listening to that sort of understands why he had to turn the music so up to tune out any other piece of doubt and talk himself into further into his delusional state and to the point of what ultimately came to be.
Yeah. You know, you'd think, oh, he's melodramatic about the way he's acting. But the problem is he carried through with it. He wasn't like acting to make an impression. He's going through that with the intent that he's going to end his life.
George was there.
Yes.
George, what did that look like when he comes out the front door?
It developed really quickly. I think we were prepared to be there for a long time, thinking it was going to be some long negotiation type thing. So I got there with one of the other guys on SWAT. The house faces east. The front door faces east. So we took a position kind of to the south at about a 90-degree angle from the front door. And two other officers took position across the street to get a direct observation of the front door so they could see somebody came out. We couldn't actually see the door from where we were at. We would have been just at an angle. We couldn't actually see the door until he crossed through the threshold off the front porch. So we were aware of where the officers were, and we had a really good containment from all sides of it. So when he came out the front door, there had been loud music, just loud rock and roll music blaring from inside the house for the whole time I was there. And if I recall correctly, the music stopped. And it had stopped a couple times before, almost like he was just changing out a tape or a CD or something like that. The music stopped, and all of a sudden the front door had opened, and the officers from across the street called out, open front door, mail coming out the front door. And within a matter, I mean, it went really fast at that point to me. We saw him emerge from the side. He had two guns in his hand. He did I describe it as a barrel roll. It's a somersault forward off the front porch into the front yard, dropped the pistol, lifted and from a kneeling position, raised his, he had like an AR-15 rifle and raised it up and pointed it across the street, because you could see the two officers across the street. I mean, they had some concealment and some cover, but their role was to see that front door. We needed to know if he was coming out of the house. We have to protect the neighbors, essentially, at that point. So as soon as I saw him take aim at them, myself and my partner were probably 25, 30 feet to his side, and we just called out to him, drop the gun, show me your hands, drop the gun. And he immediately, instead of pointing across the street, he turns attention to us at that point. And we were both sitting there. We're both, in full SWAT gear. We're armed with MP5 rifles. And as soon as he turned to us, he raised the gun at us. And we each shot multiple times. I think I fired four times at him. And the guy next to me fired several times as well. It ended really quickly. Once he went to the ground, there was a small, I think I call it a lattice work fence, a small 3-foot-high fence surrounding the front yard. We hopped over the fence, ran up to him, as did the officers from across the street, and Sergeant Dave came running from his position just not too far behind us. And we all ran up at the same time and observed him. He was wearing a vest, had all kinds of gear with him, a couple of guns, and a tape recorder was hanging around his neck.
We actually have the recording of that sequence.
It's on him. It's on him. Oh, fuck with me, then go ahead. Fuck with me, I say you! I say you, you motherfucker! I'll fucking drop your fucking ass!
I can't really.
Wow.
I can't imagine that being my everyday, what you all do.
That's really wild to hear. What happens after a moment like that?
We went to provide care to him immediately, and he was deceased immediately. There wasn't any medical transport needed at that point. He had suffered multiple gunshot wounds. I don't know the number.
And also so weird, he was wearing the tape recorder. That seems very narcissistic, I suppose.
But I think it goes back to what his attitude when he was talking to Sergeant Dave is, you know, this is going to get documented. My wife's going to know what happened. Maybe he had perceived some kind of deception or some kind of bad motives on our part, and he was going to catch us in the act, or it was just paranoia. And
one of the things he told me during my initial conversation, he had bad experiences with the cops all of his life, starting when he was a kid.
So he had did he have a record?
No, not really. He actually was a city employee for quite some time and was off on disability.
What was his wife's reaction? Because you mentioned that she was kind of fed up with his behavior. Was she surprised? Was there, what was it?
Well, she was parked right near where we were parked as part of the negotiating team. And she was there with the dogs when the gunshots rang out. Of course, I didn't really make a lot of observations of her during that because then my attention's to the gunshots. And of course, every cop that's not on a perimeter responsibility, they're heading that direction towards the gunshots to, you know, help out. But, you know, quite frankly, she handled the whole thing pretty well. Now, whether or not it was because she went into shock or she felt sooner or later this was inevitable, I don't know. But
I had several interactions with her after, including Raymond's sister coming up with her husband to try to get some, I guess, closure or facts about what had actually happened. And dealing with Wendy, she was pretty a professional woman, and she was pretty – had come to grips with what had happened. I mean, she actually even she didn't believe we had a tape recording of it, and I actually gave her a copy of it. And she wanted it. And she spoke to me several times after that about the whole thing. And I guess as far as someone who just lost her husband to, you know, gunfire from the police, usually they're, you know, ready to sue us or do whatever. And she was very understanding and actually wanted to meet and express her condolences to all the officers who fired. There was gunfire coming from three different directions when this came out. And it was pretty instant. And I believe there was like 23 shots fired and 9 of them were in him. Hmm. So,
wow.
Yeah.
And George, this may be too personal for you, but when you are involved in shooting a suspect, do you then, in, you know, on TV, they make you go to counseling and stuff. Is there any kind of extended debrief about that experience for an officer?
Yes. It's you have the opportunity for it, I say the least. So in my situation, multiple officers fired shots. There's a countywide investigation team that comes in and investigates the shooting. And that way we don't investigate our own shootings. It's an outside perspective coming in and investigating it. They give their findings to the DA. The DA reviews the investigation, determines if the deadly force use was authorized. That investigation could take anywhere from a week to a couple weeks. It depends on the scope of the case. I think this one probably took about a week to review for everybody to write reports up and the DA to determine what was lawful. So for that period of time, you are put on an administrative leave. So I'm told you're not working until this is resolved. It's normal procedure. It's not like, you know, you did something wrong, mm-hmm. but until it's investigated, you're off work.
Do you appreciate that or does that bum you out?
It kind of bums you out a little bit. I mean, you want to be at work. You want to be around the people you work with. You enjoy that atmosphere. So it feels, I don't even say bums you out. It just feels like it's not normal. Your normal days, your normal schedule is interrupted. You want to be at work. You want to get back to your caseload. You want to get back to working with the guys.
So you can't even do desk work on other cases? You're at home?
No, you're allowed to come. If you want to come to the station and work out or something like that, that's fine. But you cannot do any work at all.
You mean there's a gym there?
There's a nice gym there. we can thank our local taxpayers for taking care of that.
But, awesome. Well, you do have to be able to leave a 6-foot wall in a single bound.
Something like that. You know, going back to the gym, you need that for recovering for anything, for preparing for work.
Sure.
And it's a nice stress reliever to be able to do something like that. But this wasn't as one of those stressful
Dave is looking at Detective Dave is looking
you're calling
like
me
you're,
out.
You're out of your mind. What do you mean? It's a good stress reliever. Everybody should.
I didn't
do
even
it.
Know we had a gym.
I was going to ask you. Have you seen it?
We talk about people jumping 6-foot walls, and the other option is just to run through it, right, Dave?
Yes.
Cool. Kool-Aid Man style.
I'm going to start looking for the gym, though.
So yeah, this you go have to go see a psychologist and talk to them.
Do you like that?
No.
Why?
Because it's a stranger, you don't like talking to people, and there wasn't much to talk about, though. This situation was a pretty clear-cut use of force. I wasn't stressed out about the decision I had made. I've got a great family support system. I've got, you know,
Do you people. Talk about it with your family, your wife?
Not the specifics, no, but they know enough details about, you know, dad got in a shooting or husband got in a shooting. It's on the news. It's in the newspaper. You can't avoid it. So it helps to have people in your life that are not cops. So they normalize things. If you're around cops all the time, it probably drives you crazy. To be around other people, it normalizes everything. So you just sit and wait. And then once the DA says the shooting's clear, then you go to visit the psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever the mental health professional is. And they give you the opportunity to talk about it. They ask you some questions about how you're dealing with it. They ask you just various emotional response things to gauge whether you're fit to come back to work. And the city mandates that. The city wants to make sure that when you come back to work, you're not having problems. You're not, whether it's at work, away from work, that you're stable to come back.
Are there any, it's probably a silly question, but are there any officers who try to game the questions? So if the questions are relatively standard to gauge your fitness to go back to work, are there?
I'm sure they could. I think they could try. But I think these people, these psychologists.
The psychologist is smarter than that.
They know how to pick up on those cues when you're feeding them a line of bullshit, I think.
Yeah.
They know how to pick up on the other cues that you're not being truthful or honest or something like that. So it's just easy to go in there and just tell them how you feel. And they can gauge how you are, if you're hiding it or not. And this wasn't a situation where it had caused me a lot of stress in my life or anything like that. So I was able to return to work as soon as they cleared me the next day. And I came back to work and all was well.
And Sergeant David, do you also have to, are you put on desk duty, or they're just like, no, off you go, back to work, sit right down.
Finished my shift that day, yeah.
And how long was that, all in all, from the time you get there to the conclusion? How long did that take? You say it was really
The time that I got on the scene, it was probably less than an hour and a half before this thing would concluded in gunfire. Well, all the SWAT team hadn't even showed up yet. We were just still trying to get people in the position. You know, and it leads me to point out something here. You know, we talked about the loud music. It was so loud that I could hear it was a Beatles remix tape that was just going, just looping.
Oh, wow.
And he was in there playing it. And officers every day go to loud noise complaints, loud music. It could have been the gunfire a neighbor could have heard that. And they seemed like routine calls that you would go up and knock on the door. And these are the places you don't want to knock on the door, because you hear what he says on the tape about the first officer he sees. And it probably would have happened. And then if you just, you think you're going to go up there and tell him, hey, turn the music down, but you're going to see what might be behind the door when you talk about this guy.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that stuck with me on this case. It wasn't that special in a lot of circumstance. A guy is clearly suicide by cop. But I often wonder what would have happened if none of those other calls and stuff to his wife had happened, and it was just simply a neighbor who called the police department on the non-emergency line to complain about a loud stereo, a complaint that our patrol guys feel multiple times a day. And so you have maybe just one officer, probably two. All they're going to do is walk up to the front door and knock. Police officer, and you have no idea that you got the madman on the other side with an assault rifle.
Who's going to shoot the first officer he sees?
And thought about that in this case. That's what stuck with me, is mm-hmm. how we could have lost several officers on just the simplest of calls.
Do you consider this tactically a success? And because there were no innocent victims killed, because Raymond was brandishing weapons and had every intention of killing whichever officer he encountered, is there no feeling of we could have done that better? Or is there always a feeling we could have done that better?
Well, every time you do one of these operations, you wonder what did or didn't go wrong, or could have gone wrong, I should say. But in this particular case, like I said, we were already completely deployed as far as the SWAT team wasn't at full strength yet. There wasn't enough people on the response team that George was on yet. I was still getting people into position. I had people across the street, and I had only one officer on the north side of the residence, and there were still patrol officers on the back side of the residence that had not been relieved yet. And we were not at full strength, but we wouldn't have to make entry in a place like this. We know there's nobody else in there. We knew his wife was accounted for. So there's going to be no need for entry. So it's containment in this case. So contain him to the house. And the idea is we get the team there at full strength, contain him, and then just make his space smaller and smaller and smaller until he either talks to us or he surrenders or he does what he did. And when somebody comes out of the house and gets static, you want to make sure that your containment is good enough at that time that you keep him in that perimeter. And in this case, it did work out. So having at about, I would say two-thirds strength, we had our assets put in place that need to be put in place in the order that need to be put in place if something like this were to happen.
Because you're part of a small town and the SWAT team sort of gets pieced together, I want to know if there's ever a situation where that's really been problematic. Because, yes, in this case, no one was in the house, no one other than the guy. But if someone were in there and shit went down way faster than the full team could get there, I mean, have you ever encountered that situation?
Yeah, it's like my biggest pet peeve is people who don't answer the phone, or if they miss the call, don't instantly call back, because we don't have enough people to have people absent, really. And what it does, it makes us make a plan that is less than our best. And we have to do it on the fly, and while we're waiting for these people to show up. And sometimes when it's at 2 o'clock in the morning, it can be a pain. You know, I remember when I was a single father and I had all my kids there, and I get a call at 2 a.m. I got to figure out who's going to come and stay with their sleeping kids while I get to, and I got to hurry and get there. But those are things everyone should, we talk about that. You should have that in place before you stay on the team.
That seems like such a particularly small town feature.
Yeah, it is.
So just back to that last bit of Raymond's tape recording, I'm really struck by how much he seems to be talking himself into a scenario that will end fatally for him.
Well, I listened to him right before he's almost crying. Oh,
yeah,
and that,
right.
And then when I'm going outside, it's on. You know, he's pumping himself up to go outside and do that. And I get back to when I talked to him, and it was somebody I'd say to anybody, if you come outside with those guns, bad things are going to happen.
Yeah.
I said, I want you to come outside, but not with your weapons. And so, you know, do you wonder back, do you give him an out there? Do you say, oh, well, I don't have the guts to shoot me myself, but if I go out there with those guns, they will. And I think that's what he decided to do.
And that's the cop, suicide by cop term that you all refer to.
Yes, and that's a classic one, really is. He didn't fire one round.
Oh, my.
Both guns were loaded and had bullets in the chamber, but he didn't fire one round.
Small Town Dicks is produced by Zibby Allen and Yardley Smith for Paperclip Limited, with editing from Logan Heftel and Yardley and Zibby.
Music for the show was composed by John Forrest.
If you like what you hear, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever else you like to listen to your podcasts.
And follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Small Town Dicks. Also, visit our website, smalltowndicks.com, for more information and to leave questions and comments for the team.